So that's just the tip of the iceberg on that topic. I will cover more on this in some future podcasts.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Valkovsky, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to Education Matters here on WGTDHD. I'm your host today, Steve Brown. We have two segments. In segment one, I'll be talking with Dr. Ruby Payne. She is the author of the book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, A Cognitive Approach for Educators, Policymakers, and Employers. In segment two, a rebroadcast from 2020, an interview I did with Matthew Frazier, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Bethel versus Frazier still remains one of the quintessential landmark U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with the freedom of speech for students. And now my interview with Dr. Ruby Payne. And I'm very pleased to have as my guest this morning Dr. Ruby Payne. And Dr. Payne is an American educator, an author, best known along with many of the work that she does for a book called A Framework for Understanding Poverty, and also her work on the culture of poverty and its relationship to education. She has a PhD in educational leadership and policy studies from Loyola University in Chicago, just down the road from where we are, where I am at the moment. Anyway, Dr. Payne, welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you so much.
First of all, I always like to have my guest give an introduction about themselves that maybe doesn't always get published. Obviously, with all the books that you have written and articles and discussions, maybe you could give our listeners some background about yourself that typically would not be in an introduction or be in a book or a summary of who Ruby Payne is.
Well, probably that would be the fact that I grew up Mennonite, kind of in that same group, Amish Mennonite, that tradition. Mennonites are a bit more liberal than Amish. They have electricity. They believe in education. They have cars. But both are pacifists. And I went to a Mennonite college that required you live in a third world country for a trimester to graduate. I lived in Haiti, down in the Caribbean, sent down there to study poverty and service. And then I came back and married a man named Frank Payne, who passed away in 2010. He was a mix of Cherokee and Caucasian, and he had grown up in extreme poverty. So a lot of people don't know that, but probably my fascination in my life is how people think the way they do, how people know what they know. And I'm fascinated by that. And so that was probably the basis for the work. How do people know what they know, and how do people negotiate their environments?
Okay, very good. And you got your doctorate at Loyola University in Chicago, and I'm certainly familiar with that fine university. Give us a quick overview, if you would please, of what your dissertation topic was. And having gone through all that myself at Iowa State University, it could be a long and it can be a long experience, but worthwhile. Maybe if you could just give a brief overview of what the topic of your dissertation was and why you chose that topic.
Well, the topic of my dissertation was the relationship between cognitive styles of principals and the amount of conflict they have in their campus, how they go about conflict resolution. And I simply did that topic again. It interests me how people think and how they negotiate their environments.
Okay. And What about your own teaching experiences in the public schools or private schools? What have been your own experiences as far as teaching?
Well, I taught high school for 9 years in a high school in Illinois and then one in Texas. I was in central office. I worked for regional service centers, intermediate units, one in Texas and one in Illinois, Grays Lake, Illinois, and Corpus Christi, Texas. I was in central office as a curriculum specialist, a staff development specialist. Then I was an elementary principal in Barrington, Illinois. And so then I wrote the book.
And we'll talk more about your company, AHA. Let's maybe drill down, if we could. Your book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, A Cognitive Approach, copy that I have that I got from you at the conference down in Houston, is the sixth edition. Before we talk about some of the topics in your book, why does Ruby Payne think that this book, and now in its sixth edition, number one, is so popular, and why people are always quoting your book and what you talk about in that framework?
I think it's because it gives people a different lens to see their students. There's a lot of criticism about it because it doesn't use a social justice frame, theoretical frame. It uses a social cognitive frame, which again is how people think and how they negotiate environments. And what I hear over and over and over and over again from educators is it changed my teaching, it changed my life. I'll ask them how. How did it change? What are they doing differently? And typically what they say is nothing. They'll say, I just think about it differently. And they'll say things like this. I don't judge them anymore. If there's an issue, I think, what haven't I thought about? What do they need to know that I don't know they need to know? Changes the nonverbals.
A few questions then, if we can sort of delve into that. What does it mean in from your point of view and the work you've done, the research that you've done, that high poverty schools in our country seem to have more teachers teaching outside of their areas of certification? Is that still true? Is that still something that exists only in high poverty schools, or is it happening all over the country? And of course, I'll put the one comment that during the pandemic and right now we have a shortage. I think the last figure I heard was something like a million teacher shortage right now in this country. But what are your thoughts about whether in high poverty schools across the country, that oftentimes there are teachers teaching in areas that in which they're not certified?
Well, it's particularly egregious in math. In 10 years ago, and I'm sure it's worse now, 10 years ago, 40% of poor and minority students had an Algebra 1 teacher who's not credentialed in math. And Algebra 1 is the gatekeeper course for graduating from high school. Keeps more kids from poverty and more minority kids from graduating than any other course. And you think that you have somebody teaching it who isn't even credentialed in math. That's like having a gatekeeper who doesn't have a key to the gate. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just criminal, in my opinion.
As you look at your own experiences, being in higher education, as well as being a public school administrator and teacher, what provisions do teachers need to make now in 2021 if they have children in their classrooms who would be categorized as in poverty?
Well, one of the things that they're going to have to shift, in my opinion, is they're going to have to, if we're going to reach this generation of kids now, and first of all, let me just say this, COVID decimated a lot of structures. It just decimated them. Structures of time, structures of trust, structures like, for example, cheating is now a huge issue in schools. How do you reestablish that? Another one is how do you reestablish structures and interactions? I was just in a school yesterday in Oklahoma, and they were telling me about the number of students who are just absolutely in your face with the teacher now, okay? And the number of parents that way. Our structures of civility. And one of the things I'm going to say is I think that right now the whole emphasis has been on cognitive learning, cognitive disciplines, theoretical frames. And I'm going to say that all learning is double-coded emotionally and cognitively, and we're going to have to look at the emotional underpinnings of learning and the emotional underpinnings of the discipline if we're going to move successfully into the next decade. And that is something that colleges and universities are doing nothing with right now. Mm-hmm. It's considered a separate discipline, psychology, and it's not interwoven into the understanding of learning.
You know, that's a good lead into my next question, and that is, do teachers at any level, whether they're in our public schools, private schools, or in higher education, do they need special training to work with students who do come from poverty?
Yes, because otherwise they judge them negatively. You only can see the world through your lens, okay? Unless someone says to you, well, let's look at race. In the research, if you have a very good friend who's a different sexual persuasion or a different race than you are, you see that whole world very differently, okay? If you have knowledge and understandings of another way to view the reality, then you will treat it differently. And so that's really important, I think, as we negotiate that. And all children right now, regardless of class issues, financial issues, all children right now are, because of COVID, are having unstable emotional experiences. And those are not understood at all. Right now, if you higher ed only requires, most teacher certification programs only require that you have any kind of background at all in emotional development if you are a counselor, special ed, or early childhood. Nobody else gets any of that information.
We've talked briefly about the pandemic, about the with regards to the impact on all students, regardless of who they are, where they live, what their areas of specialization or focus might be. But as you look at the last 16, 18 months and into the future with regards to how COVID has impacted teachers on a day-to-day basis, increasing their stress, what additional impact or dangers do we need to really look at as we go forward, let's say over the next 5 to 10 years, with the impact of COVID and the pandemic and the issues that you have always talked about over the years about the impact of poverty on education?
Well, there's two or three things that I think we're going to have to pay attention to if we're going to help them negotiate. Number one is in state assessment. Okay, state assessment right now has all kinds of formulas and criteria for rigor. It has no formulas and no criteria for relevance, okay? And that's where the emotional attachment comes into learning. What does this matter to me? How is this important to me? How does it help me negotiate my environment? What we're seeing right now in kids after COVID is they're simply not going to engage unless it's got an emotional attachment to them, unless there's some sort of relevance. So the second thing I think that we're going to have to look at is right now the kids are coming in emotionally a year and a half to 2 years behind where they normally are. Okay, and that's because they haven't had the social interaction. Let's just look at adolescent brains right now briefly. Adolescent brains restructure during adolescence. And one of the things that's critical in their restructuring is social interaction. They haven't gotten that during COVID, okay? And interacting on a screen is not the same thing. So one of the things that's happened to adolescents, for example, the problem is you're wiring your brain as it's being rewired to a screen instead of to a person, which the long-term impact of that can be social isolation. And social isolation is incredibly damaging for your health. So I think one of the things we're going to be looking at down the road is I'm already working on a project with relational intelligence, because we're going to have to, I think, actually teach that if we're going to help them negotiate impact of the pandemic.
You talk about in your book the hidden rules of class, and I was wondering, first of all, if you could just give a brief overview of what that means. I mean, when I and by the way, I use your book and materials in classes that I've taught in school administration. But this whole concept of hidden rules of class, what does it mean? And what can we do today in 2021 as teachers, as parents, as school administrators?
Well, let me say, first of all, that's gotten a lot of criticism because people think it's stereotypes. But if you understand it that way, then yes. But it's really actually when you see this behavior, you kind of understand why the person is doing that to survive their environment. We have all kinds of hidden rules. People are comfortable with that. I'll usually ask an audience, have you been in an environment, a social setting that was so uncomfortable you could not wait to leave? And almost everybody says yes. And it's because of those unspoken hidden rules that we're operating. And what happens is different environments require different sets of understanding to survive. And in we identify in the book that poverty and wealth is really about a set of 8 or 9 resources. It's not just about money. Like, for example, one of them is physical health. If you don't have physical health, that significantly impacts how you negotiate your environment. And so what we look at is how those rules influence stability or instability. So, for example, we look at how people spend their time, because that's one of the ways that we are universally alike. Everybody's got 24 hours a day. So how you take that time and use it depends a lot who you know and what you know. And that knowledge basis, who and what, help you negotiate environments. So, for example, if you're in a stable environment, which we call middle class, in other words, you know where you're going to sleep at night, you know you got food every day. The driving force for decisions is almost always work, achievement, and material security. So in other words, I spend my time at work, I spend my time getting educated, I buy things that become an asset, like a mortgage. And middle class has got 4 rules about money. I don't ask you for money and you don't ask me. Number 2, you never quit a job until you have another one. Number 3 is that if you borrow money, you've got to pay it back, okay? And one of the things, you have these rules that you use to negotiate your environment. Another rule is you never tell people your salary, okay? But if you're in wealth and new money and old money, particularly old money, and you've been there 2 generations or more, you have a different problem. Your problem is you have more resources than you can take care of by yourself. So that means you have to hire people, which means your safety is jeopardized. So you're going to make your decisions, it's your connections, your financial, social, and political connections, because they help you survive your environment. And so that leads to another hidden rule. When you go to a party among the truly wealthy, you don't introduce yourself. But if you go to a party among the middle class and you don't introduce yourself, you're a snob. Wealth uses it to identify whether you're safe or not, the introduction. But if you're in poverty and you've been there 2 generations, there's generational poverty and working poverty. Then you got a different problem. Your problem is that you don't have any materials. So your decisions are made every day against survival, entertainment, and relationships, because people keep you alive.
And talking about the role of teachers, I know you've talked in the past about the question, you know, do teachers teach differently with respect to their background?
Well, it's how you shape your reality. Like, let me just give you one example. This has nothing to do with class, it has to do with life experience. One of my consultants, his mother died in childbirth between the 5th and the 6th grade, between the 6th and the 7th grade year, okay? 7th grade, he goes to school, the first day of school, he's very unhappy about his mother's death, he's still angry about it. Math teacher, she gives him an assignment to do, he refuses to do it, he just sits there. She says, if you don't finish your work, I'm going to call your mother. And he says to her, if you can blankety blank do that, I'd love to talk to her myself. And for that, he gets kicked out. That's an example of how your environmental experience shapes what you say to a kid when you have no concept of what that child is dealing with at the moment.
Let's talk a bit about the criticisms that people level against you. About your writings, your books, or even you yourself. Paul Gorski, I mentioned him, who was an assistant professor at George Mason University, has been openly critical of the work that you do. First of all, just from a perspective of how you react to such criticisms, I guess the question is, how do you react when someone is openly critical? How does it make you feel?
Well, at first it was devastating because I couldn't understand what was driving the criticism. And we tried to have a dialogue with him and he absolutely refused. Okay.
So you're saying, by the way, I was just going to ask you, so you have never been on a panel or a one-on-one with him or an interview where they would have him and you and an interviewer?
No, we tried to do that, okay? We tried to get him, I just tried to have a conversation with him. I invited him, he absolutely refused, okay?
Okay.
And he said publicly that it was his goal to eliminate Ruby Payne and her work. Okay, so it wasn't just about the work. It was about the person, okay? And as I came to understand it, there was a group of colleagues that he had with him that were supporting him in that effort. And when I talked to higher ed professors about it who were not critical, they pointed out a couple things to me. They said, well, really, they said, in the field of social work, sociology, social justice focuses on either race, class, or gender. And they said, the criticism is, Ruby, that you don't make race a part of your conversation about class. And so there's a belief in higher ed that if the race discussion gets polluted with the class discussion, that it will mute the voice of race. But I've come to kind of understand that. Now, at 20 years of this kind of criticism, I'm kind of like, I'm actually surprised there isn't more, actually, because it's become such a controversial topic.
Before I ask you a question about critical race theory, talking about a controversial topic, and I think I mentioned to you before that I'm also a school board member, and I hear what happens at school board meetings. Not with my board or our meetings, but elsewhere. What do you think teachers today need to know that if you were structuring a teacher education program at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi, and you live right near there, and I taught there, by the way, as you know, what kind of changes would you make in a teacher education program that would be different than, let's say, 10 years ago?
One of the things I'd recommend and require as a reading material is the book, The Color of Law. If you really want to understand how the patterns get distorted, how true race discrimination, in my opinion, has to do with how the laws are structured and the inability to have wealth creation. The denial to access for wealth creation. And I think that if there were a lot less rhetoric in teacher training programs and a lot more facts, you would get a lot more traction.
Okay. Regarding critical race theory, as you watch and listen to all the news reports, I don't care whether you're watching MSNBC or CNN or Fox News or even on the BBC News, world news, they cover all these sorts of things here in the United States. How do you view critical race theory in terms of the work that you do, the research that you do?
Well, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. I think people need facts. For example, One of the underlying things that's driven it is a law that was passed in the early 1600s in Virginia that promoted the whole thing of miscegenation. And most people don't know about miscegenation. And the bottom line, it became the driver for laws for 400 years. For me, I think what makes critical race theory leaves people so divided is that it's a lot of opinion-based, it doesn't give lots of data for people to make up their own opinion.
As you look at the work that you've done, the publishing you've done, maybe if you could share some new projects you're working on, some things that are either on the drawing board or are already up and running that our audience might be interested in hearing about.
Well, what most educators don't know about is we have a whole division of the company that works with communities and educating adults in poverty so that they have more choice. Okay, people always act on the information base they have. People act on what they know. Okay, so the question becomes, how do you provide that? If you have to spend 8 hours a day hunting food, that identifies your ability, that changes what you can have time to learn. One of the things we work with that, and we've taken 100,000 adults in poverty through a program called Getting Ahead and Get My World, and we've got incredible ROI on that. Return on investment. So one of the things I'm working on is how do we translate. We have a community effort that we're bringing communities together across political divides, across political persuasions. And what we're trying to say to them is, look, if there's four causes for poverty, and if you only address one of them, you're never going to get any traction. And what we say is, if you really want to get traction, then your policies and your procedures and your systems issues have to address all four.
One of the last questions I always like to ask of a guest is there anything that we haven't talked about? Is there any question that I have not asked that I should have asked? And you were thinking, you know, why didn't Steve ask me this?
Well, what I'd like to say to your listeners out there is that I hope there are people who are going to pick up the mantle and take us, young people, and by young, I mean 30s and 40s, who will take education to the next place it needs to go, where it's compassionate, where it is holistic for students and their well-being. The future of America depends on it. So I hope whoever's listening to this is thinking about, what can I do to drive this discussion for the next 3 or 4 decades? Because that's what it's going to take.
And if any of our listeners want to know more about the work you do and AHA, how can they access that on the internet?
I would recommend that they go to www.ahaprocess.com. And there's tons of information on there.
Dr. Ruby Payne, thank you so much for joining me on Education Matters today.
Thank you.
And now in segment two, my guest is Matthew Frazier, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Bethel versus Frazier still remains one of the quintessential cases dealing with the First Amendment rights of students. My guest this morning is Matthew Frazier, and Matthew is joining us from Berkeley, California. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
When a high school student nominated a fellow student for a student-elected office, the student, according to the court, used elaborate, graphic, and explicit sexual metaphor to refer to the other student. It resulted in a suspension and carried into a court case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm very pleased to welcome as my very special guest today here on Education Matters, Matthew Frazier, whose U.S. Supreme Court case still remains one of the most important landmark First Amendment cases decided by the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1986, the case of Bethel versus Frazier. Matt, welcome so much to Education Matters.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
We're taping this interview on March the 4th of 2020. This case was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on March the 3rd of 1986. So that's 34 years ago yesterday that this was argued. Let's talk about April 26th of 1983. What happened that day at the high school about the speech? Give us some insight into what you went through.
I was supposed to be the campaign manager for another student for an election. The kid came to me, Jeff Coleman, and said they've apparently told Matt Taylor that because he's also like the vice president of the student body, that he can't run. Matt Taylor was charged with running the assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So they told Jeff and Matt Taylor that Matt Taylor could not speak on behalf of Jeff. So the way ours was set up was just that every kid got to pick somebody and call them their campaign manager, and that person gave a little one-minute speech on their behalf. And then the student spoke for, you know, whatever, 1 to 2 minutes, and that was it. And then the students listened to all that. The assembly typically lasts 30 to 45 minutes, depending on how many kids are running, for 3 or 4 or 5 different offices. And then the next day, they have kids vote in the first period class, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
By the way, were you involved in student government and active in student government?
Off and on, I had been the parliamentarian, which was sort of an appointed thing because I had done a lot of speech and debate activities and mm-hmm. was fairly successful and sort of known for that. And so they had me do that, where I just kind of explained and ruled on parliamentary procedure questions for them. You know, I was on the debate team, I was on the school newspaper. So really all went down over the course of a couple hours. The student, Jeff Coleman, came to me and said, Matt Taylor cannot give this speech. Could you come up with something? You know, over the course of 5 to 10 minutes, I wrote out this little speech. I went around and showed it to, I think, 3 different teachers. and got their opinions, which ranged from a history teacher saying, oh, that'll raise some eyebrows, to my debate teacher, who was a young guy, Sean Madden, and he thought it was hilarious and, you know, that I should do it. And he was actively encouraging me that he thought it was fine. And then I showed it to the newspaper teacher, Irene Hicks, and, you know, she said she thought it was in poor taste, but, you know, my choice whether to do it. So I went and gave the speech at the assembly. It went relatively without event. Kids hooted and hollered and laughed during the speech and then after it was done. But, you know, nobody, supposedly, I didn't see this, but supposedly during the speech, two kids got up and sort of waved their hips at each other in what the school said was some sort of simulated sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then one student got up and sort of like shook his hand in the air in what they said was some sort of, you know, mimicry or gesture of male masturbation,
right,
trying to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
So that, they said, kids hooted and hollered and stamped their feet. Then the kid got up and spoke. Everybody laughed. He just said a few sentences and said, yeah, that's me. I will fight for you. I will do a great job. Please vote for me. And that was it. So, you know, he was like, look, I'm not very funny. You know, it's the kid I'm running against, Chip Upchurch, is a really funny kid. Because I was like, well, what do you want me to do? You just want me to say Jeff Coleman's a great kid. He's been on the debate team. Blah, blah, blah. He's like, I don't know. Can you just make it funny? Can you make it funny? Because, you know, that's, if they think it's cool or funny, then I'll probably do a lot better in the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chip Upchurch, this other kid, was actually in the room when I wrote it, because he was on the debate team as well.
Now, how soon before the speech was given did you actually write it?
45 minutes. I went around and showed it to the three teachers.
Okay.
And then it was the end of the day and time for the assembly. It was,
okay,
you know, 2:30 in the afternoon.
Okay.
So, and then I was the first person. Matt Taylor got up, called the assembly to order, said, we're going to dive right in. Everybody, you know, feel free to have your applause, but please, you know, be appropriate. And we'll start with Matt Fraser. So I went and got up, and just from having shown it to a half dozen kids in the newspaper class, word seemed to have spread, because when I got up, kids were like laughing and like, ooh, what's going to happen? And then when I started giving the speech, like the first line of it is, I know a man who is firm. He's firm in his shirt. He's firm in his pants. And his character is firm. And even when I said he's firm in his shirt, like 50 kids went, ooh. And so somehow it had already spread. Like, you know, those six kids had told like 30 or 40 other kids in the course of like 20 minutes, half an hour, hey, something's going on with his speech. You should check it out. And so that's it. So I gave the speech, and then after we got out of the assembly, which was very short, there weren't a lot of kids running. It was only like 30 minutes maybe. Everybody got into the hallway. I'm feeling really good. You know, kids are going, Fraser, high five. Dude, that was sweet. That was awesome. Feeling pretty good about it. And then over the intercom comes, Matthew Fraser, come to the main office.
Uh-oh.
Matthew Fraser, come to the office.
Uh-oh.
Immediately.
Matt's in trouble.
So it just, the rest of it kind of went from there in short order. They suspended me the next morning. And that first afternoon, they sent me home. They had a little meeting. They called me in. That literally lasted 3 minutes. I did not provide them a copy of the speech.
Hmm.
I wanted a chance to consult with some advisors. And when I went home, I knew enough to call the American Civil Liberties Union in Seattle. And actually, like an hour later, that was towards the end of the day, I thought they just were not going to help me. The head of the ACLU in Seattle called me back at about 5:15. I was there home alone. My parents weren't home. And said, Matt Fraser, this is the executive director of the Seattle American Civil Liberties Union, and we're very excited about your speech. We actually think this could be a groundbreaking free speech case. We have 20 First Amendment attorneys and professors at the major law schools on a from throughout the country, and with our headquarters back in Washington, D.C., doing a phone consultation right now. We have three different attorneys who have volunteered to be a pro bono attorney, and we're very excited that this appears to be a pure free speech case.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me a few questions, like, you know, did you hit anybody? Did you act out? Did you smash a window? Did you curse out the administrators or act out in any way? And they said one problem they have is that they don't get cases, usually are not pure cases. They're not isolated to a single issue. The kid who will do a speech like this is often sort of got behavior issues. And the school, you know, and I tell this to your administrators when I've talked to them in the past in training, mm-hmm. that, it, you know, as a practical matter, if the kid does three different things wrong and one of them was curse you out, you can punish them for cursing you out and just sort of note that you really don't appreciate their behavior on these other issues. And the ACLU said, well, if anything like that has happened, we it's not worth our time, because if you've acted out in a way that they can punish you, the court is going to accept that that's what the punishment is mm-hmm. for. But my case was a straight free speech case. I had always gotten along well with the school administrators. You know, I was the debate kid who did well at debate and, you know, wrote a column in the school newspaper and was in the top, you know, few percent of my class and went to UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Was one of the only kids to go out of state to a major university, that sort of thing.
Sure.
So I was not a bad kid, and the school administrators, when they talked about me, were actually very generous, and I thought very mature and, you know, reasonable people. And in retrospect, it sort of made me feel bad that I gave them such a hard
sure.
time. They were always like, Matt's a great kid. We wrote him a recommendation. We would do it again. We just don't like what he did on this speech, and we're going to punish it if the courts let us.
Let's draw back, and you quoted a bit of the speech. Do me a favor for our audience and read or recite the entire speech from beginning to end.
No problem. It's very
please.
Short, about
okay.
1 minute or less.
Okay.
And this is the speech I gave. I know a man who is firm. He's firm in his pants. The one I'm reading from actually has it backwards. I know a man who is firm. He's firm in his shirt, he's firm in his pants, and his character is firm. But most of all, his belief in you, the students of Bethel, is firm. Jeff Coleman is a man who takes his point and pounds it in. If necessary, he'll take any issue and nail it to the wall. You see, Jeff doesn't attack things in spurts. He drives hard, pushing and pushing, until finally he succeeds. Jeff will go to the very end, even the climax, for each and every one of you. So please vote for Jeff for Associated Student Body Vice President, because he'll never come between you and the best your high school can be. Trial, which only lasted, you know, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
They took it, we went before a federal judge,
mm-hmm.
Jeff Tanner.
Right.
We actually had their side go first.
Mm-hmm.
They called me as a witness and only had a couple questions for me.
Oh, really? Okay.
And they basically asked the question, did you know that there was sexual innuendo in your speech? And I said, yes, I did.
Of course.
And they're like, so you knew that there was sexual innuendo in your speech? Yes, I did. You know, and my attorney asked just a few questions. You did walk around the school and show this to three different teachers. Did any teacher tell you that you would be punished for giving this speech or that it violated any school rule? No. Were you encouraged to give it at all? What exactly did they say? And I went through. The debate teacher told me he thought it was very clever and probably would be effective and make everyone laugh. The history teacher said, oh, Matt Fraser, you're always yanking everyone's chain. And he said, I'm sure that's going to raise some eyebrows. Those are true statements that he said. And then the newspaper teacher told me that she thought it was in poor taste and she wasn't sure that it was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the strongest admonition. Nobody said, if you do this, you're going to get in trouble. So, you know, there was an argument on our part that there really wasn't prior notice, that the teachers are the, you know, sort of appendage of school discipline.
Sure.
And that when a student shows you a speech they're going to give before the school assembly, that, you know, if the school has a problem with it, that's the time. You know, I wasn't hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know. And then also, you know, they controlled the assembly. They could have just turned off the microphone or said, no, stop, this speech is out of bounds, so your time is over. They were in charge. It was their production. And they had the option to ask students to turn the speeches in advance, but mm-hmm. they didn't do that. So those are some of the arguments we made that I believe are strong arguments. You know, we made the argument that this was at a student government assembly. And if kids are supposed to learn free speech, you know, this is the 1 hour of the year where the students are told, okay, you're mock politicians. you know, your consequences for what you say are whether you get elected and how you're perceived by the students and your teachers. And we were given the freedom to just give our speeches.
As you look at the case now, 34 years later, since the court decision, and you, we talked about this at the beginning, what kinds of advice would you give to students today as well as to teachers and administrators in terms of acceptable speech in our public schools today?
Well, you know, they cannot promote drug use in any way.
Mm-hmm.
The court did not even explain in Morris v. Frederick why Bong Hits for Jesus actually promotes drug use. I mean, they said it could be viewed as sort of a veiled code speak mm-hmm. for promoting drug use.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Frederick says that it was just some nonsense words he put together, sort of poking fun of religion and school and pot as an issue. I don't know. You know, an interesting question is, could a student wear a T-shirt about a more that is clearly not a veiled drug message, that's just a policy issue?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of communities and states have legalized pot.
Right.
Can a student wear a T-shirt that says, legalize pot to fund our schools now? I mean, that is almost the same thing
sure.
as Bong Hits for Jesus.
Matt, I want to thank you so much for your time, and more so thank you for all the work that you have done in the past and that you're doing now. I know that you and I will stay in touch. Best regards to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all the great work you're doing.
I'd like to thank Dr. Ruby Payne for the time she took this morning for the interview, talking about her book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, and also Matthew Frazier, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Bethel versus Frazier still remains a landmark case in the area of free speech for students. For Education Matters, here on WGTD HD, I'm Steve Brown, thanking you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Okay, Carol. You know, I will not be nervous during this wonderful holiday show here at Lake Lawn Resort. Steve Brown and Mike Ulstrup would never want me to be nervous. Those show producers are always keeping my spirits up. And you know, or I should say, I know. I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh or sing a song. Okay, that's much better. I feel fine now. Let's get this show going.
Ladies and gentlemen, as our band is doing their final rehearsal, we have about 60 seconds before we go live, so I want to remind all of you to please silence your cell phones, sit back, relax, and most of all, have lots of fun for today's live broadcast of the WGTD Radio Theater, which, by the way, is show number 128 in this, our 17th season. And I'm very pleased to welcome, before we start the show, because we're not even on the air yet, as everyone knows, I want to introduce the mayor of the city of Delavan, Wisconsin, Mr. Ryan Schrader.
Thank you, Stephen, for that very nice introduction. And as mayor, it's my honor to welcome all of you that are here in person and those tuning in to the city of Delavan and a historic Lake Lawn Resort. So you're in for a real treat, and enjoy the show today.
Thank you, Ryan Schrader. And by the way, Ryan is also a member of the 91.1 Players.
30 seconds still air, everyone.
So just in case I forget, before we go on the air, let me tell all of you here in the audience here at Lake Lawn Resort in beautiful Delavan that support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah Dumay and McTernan, the Brown-Elster Performing Arts Foundation, located in Salem Lakes, Wisconsin, and, of course, Lake Lawn Resort, right here in Delavan, Wisconsin.
Well, if it isn't our wonderful show announcer, Steve Brown, doing such a great job.
Well, Carol, thank you. But, you know, that's most gracious of you. But, by the way, will you be pulling your left ear for us on the air?
Why? Of course I will. And I'm sure our radio listening audience will see it all, live.
Carol, you know, I've always wanted to know why you
pulled your left earlobe during your shows?
Steve, I know we only have a few seconds before we go on live, but I've always pulled on my ear since about 1955 or so, when I was on the Paul Winchell Show with Jerry Mahoney and Knucklehead. And I did it then, and I still do it for my grandmother. Or should I say, my Nana.
You know, that's an incredible story, and thank you so much for sharing that with me and with our entire audience here in the studio. But you know what? I better stop right now.
Quiet, everyone. In 5, 4, 3.